Okay, so it's September 28th, 2016. I'm Rick Hansen. And as you probably know, we're taking this year to explore mindfulness and using the Buddha's very practical fundamental teachings in the frame of the four foundations or four establishments of mindfulness as a framework here. The first one being mindfulness of the body, really getting in touch with ourselves. Second foundation, with that deep mindfulness of the body, really tracking the sense of experience moment to moment to moment as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then in the third foundation of mindfulness, being really aware of what happens after something is pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. Do we be with it, allow it, let it flow with a kind of internal shock absorber? Or do we get reactive to it in ways subtle or gross? Okay, so we're in the third foundation of mindfulness now, which is a lot about awareness of kind of global states of mind. You know, is next week I'll talk probably about the group of things to be aware of that are about non-ordinary states of awareness. But today's, and we've been focusing on states of awareness that the Buddha describes, is your mind colored with fear, anger, helplessness, in a word, hatred, or peace, a sense of calm strength, seeing threats accurately? Is your mind colored, my mind as well, with a sense of frustration, addiction, drivenness, disappointment, or colored with a sense of contentment, gladness, fullness already, gratitude? Is the mind colored with a sense of ignorance, confusion, delusion, false beliefs, kind of living in a, you know, fictional world, or not? You know, is it a mind in which there's clarity? Vipassana, insight, clear seeing. And last, is it a mind that's distracted, stimulation hungry, darting from this to that, skittering about, or not? Instead, a mind that's composed, steady, clear, walking evenly over uneven ground. Right? That's the thing. And so tonight I'd like to talk about one of the major qualities to pay attention to and also one of the major factors of that tipping point. Which way do we tip? There's no end to pleasant, no end to unpleasant, no end to neutral. I would add no end to heartfelt because we're so profoundly connected and social as beings and as a species. There's no end to that. The only question is, which way do we tip when the worldly winds blow? Praise or blame? Fame or ill repute? Pleasure or pain? What's the last couplet? Pain or sorrow, something. Anyway, okay, you got it. All right, so I want to talk about self, the I, this fundamental topic in psychology, philosophy, Eastern tradition, certainly in Buddhism. The Buddha said that existence had three fundamental characteristics. And he's talking not so much about external material reality. He's talking about human existence. What's it like to be us? He said, well, fundamentally, it's always changing. Experience, the stream of consciousness, is continually changing. Even things that seem stable, like the image of a particular spot on a wall, or you know, the idea of somebody itself has a kind of quivering to it. A sensation in your knee feels like it's vibrating when you look really closely at it. It's changing. Second major characteristic, there is suffering. There is pain. We beyond pain, most people are not, me included, are not completely free of unnecessary but very tenacious suffering. There is suffering. And then the third characteristic, he said, is that if you look really, really closely, no I can be found. So in Pali, the words have a particular ring to them. We have, kind of lost it tonight. Anyway, we have anicca, impermanence. We have dukkha, suffering. and we have anatta, not self. Okay? So that's the Buddha's claim. Those are his hypotheses. Right? What do we think? So we have this thing in there, not self. Now, his original framing of that, as best we can gather, was he was critiquing the Jain Hindu view of the time, 2,500 or so years ago, that there was an absolutely self-existing soul essence that was causeless and endless, and flitting from life to life to life. And he challenged that view. And then on the heels of that, the critique of the notion of some entity inside us became more and more psychological. Okay. Now, this territory can get complicated, messy, metaphysical really fast. I do a whole day on it at Spirit Rock, including grounding this consideration of self, not self, in underlying neuropsychology, which is actually very helpful in this area, I think. It's not that helpful in many other areas, but in this area, I think it's pretty helpful. So there's a lot about this topic, and who knows, it may spill over into next week, right? But I want to kind of try to boil it down to some practical details to be mindful of, and then talk about it, see what you think, okay? So the first practical detail is to distinguish between person and self, or I. And the word self is used typically in two different ways. One is to describe the whole person. You know, there is a person here that has a unique body-mind over time. Persons exist. Persons are distinct from each other. Camille is a person over there. Rick is a person over here. Okay. There are persons, pretty clearly. But is there a ghost in the machine? Right? Is there a unified, enduring, fundamentally independent being looking out through your eyes? Kind of a deep question, isn't it? And under the heading of being mindful of what tips us into more or less suffering as the worldly winds blow, including the ones inside us, that sense of and presumptions about there being an internal entity inside, called an I, you know, looking out at the field of the person, kind of like that little kid you see, I think, some of these movies, a little child inside a giant or a huge robot, you know, in the command center, pulling on the levers, trying to make it go the right way. Because when you have a sense that there is, and when I say you, I mean the person. There is a mind here, there is personality. Persons include personalities, persons include history, persons include volition, persons include executive functions, persons include moral duties, moral rights. Persons can include all those things. We can have all those things. Persons can decide to open a door or close it, answer the phone or hang up the phone. But that doesn't mean necessarily that there's an entity inside. Okay? So we have this fundamental distinction between persons and I's, or selves. Okay? There's a fundamental teaching about this that is really clear when you see it in writing. It goes, love yourself. Just don't love your self. See the distinction? Self as I. That's where it gets really troubled. So that's the first kind of distinction to track. The second distinction to track is between the I and the me. What's meant by that is that if you, the person, watch the mind, you'll see this notion of me pulled up often in your own internal movies, right? What will it be like for me to talk with you that way? See? Or will it go well for me if I do that? Or what happened to me in the past? So you do mental time travel, you have both an I and a me. You have an I reflecting on or examining or you know, a presumed I, rather, reflecting on or examining or imagining what it might be like for, what was it like then, various me's over time. So you see that distinction right there between the I and the me? That's helpful. We can, and it gives us a way to be aware, gives us language for our own process. Because it's all unfolding in the person process. You know, the mind process, Tarane's mind process, Bill's mind process, Rick's mind process, your mind process, just unfolding. Inside that unfolding mind process, various eyes emerge and then kind of pass away. Various presumptions about an entity I arise and pass away. Various me's arise and pass away. All that's like flotsam and jetsam, you know, bottles, children's diapers, leaves, twigs, candy bars, beach balls, floating down the stream of consciousness. Right? You can recognize it like that, okay? It's not a problem that I's and me's arise and pass away in the larger streaming of consciousness. The problem is when we privilege them, when we make them special. And as the Buddha put it, nothing is to be clung to as I or mine, right? It's not, it's when we hop on board those perspectives. I think this about Bernie Sanders, right? I feel that way about the 49ers quarterbacking decisions. Who knows, you know? Or we jump on board it. Or how dare you treat me that way? That's when you can just watch the contraction, the taking it personally, the possessiveness, my precious, et cetera, et cetera. All that stuff begins and suffering increases. Okay, so we have eyes and means, and we have selfing kind of as process, as a subset of personing, and being able to recognize these distinctions in your experience, not philosophically, but in your actual experience. Okay? So here's another distinction. Which comes first, I or the desire? So, if there's already a strong sense of me, 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 I, we tend to be more reactive to threats and the unpleasant, and we tend to tip more into suffering as a result. Okay? If we come into a situation very self-conscious, you ever go to a party, you're really self-conscious for some reason, or a new gathering, you step into a group at work or a different scene, or you feel like you don't quite belong there. You know, you're wearing a tux to a beach party or a swimsuit to a funeral, something like that, you know, or they're all real young and hip and you're old and boring and whatever, or vice versa. You just feel out of sorts. They come from a red state and you come from a blue state. Who knows? You just feel out of, you feel different. You know, when you're really self-conscious, it's very easy to take offense, isn't it? It's easy to get anxious. It's easy to contract. It's easy to get irritated. It's easy to kind of spin out in a deluded way, get distracted by this or that. So sometimes it is true that selfing creates suffering. Selfing creates desire that creates suffering. But if it's also a lot true the other way, that you can watch in real time. And that's where mindfulness can be incredibly helpful. There you are. There's very little sense of I. There's ongoing, you're awake. The person's awake. There's ongoing being as you, right? You're not a zombie. You're just kind of rolling through life. Something's happening. And then there is something sharply unpleasant, like suddenly there's a pain in your body. And attention zeroes in on that pain. You can just watch in real time, half second by half second, quarter second by quarter second, second by second. Fear of the pain, a thought cascade about the pain, what to do about the pain, with a growing sense of me, growing sense of I. On the heels of the unpleasant and the cascade of desire related to the unpleasant. Or flip the other way. If it's really pleasant, you're just kind of rolling on, and suddenly out of the corner of your eye, you're just wandering through the mall, just wandering through the mall, suddenly you see this flash of a beautiful, rich salmon color, my wife's favorite color. And, you know, suddenly your eye goes, whing. And there's not much sense of eye, but suddenly desire starts focusing down on that, you know, salmon, cashmere, nice cowl neck, sweater, Gap. Looks like it's on sale too, you know. Start zeroing in, and very quickly, I want it. Can I get it? What will my husband think about it? He'll like it. He won't like it. You know, I, right? You see, I. And the third major trigger, and it makes sense, right? Very unpleasant, very pleasant, or very social. You're just walking down the street, not much sense of self. Suddenly somebody comes around a corner, or you're in your home, the phone rings, and it's a person, and suddenly there's a strong sense of I, and a kind of presumption of an I over there too. Anyway, so you can be mindful of that. The point is to watch, to be with, the increasing or decreasing sense of I. And in the process of watching that increasing or decreasing sense of I, there can be a very useful recognition that there is no enduring, unified entity inside. It's like there's an I committee with many, many members. You know, some of them more or less coming to the fore. It's continually changing. It's compounded. The I is compounded. Subpersonalities, the one who really determines to, you know, wake up at 6:30 in the morning to exercise, and the one who at 6:30 in the morning hears the buzzer going off and who's at the damp clock, you know, like that. Different eyes, right? You can also see that in addition to the eye not being unified, it's not enduring because it's continually kind of changing a little bit or changing a lot, rising and falling, ebbing and flowing. It doesn't have that sense of continuity to it. And you also can see that that I is not independent. It's not, in a sense, free in relationship to reality. It's conditioned. It is conditioned, too. It is shaped. It is affected by experiences. And it's not just that experiences happen to an I, but that the I itself is changing because of the experiences we have, or the forces in us or upon us, moment to moment to moment. So this is and then the last thing. So okay, so far this is like a quick run through major clarities about the eye. You can start to spin out about it. The way to do it is not to get philosophical, but to keep coming into experience. What's going on here? You know, tracking the difference, for example, between there is hearing and I am hearing. Tracking the difference, you know. So two more distinctions. I'm going to put this. One of the things that happens for us as incredibly social species, and if you think about the movement in childhood as we grow up and we get older, we presume about others what we recognize in ourselves, but we also presume about ourselves what we recognize in others. And we tend to regard others as unified because there's just one body over there, right? Like if I see Tricia, I normally, you know, by habit just go, there's a Tricia there. Tricia, one word, right? Rather than look over there and go, what a mess. What a chaotic, you know, zoo-like menagerie of subpersonalities, forces, dynamic processes, you know, all kinds of this activity at all levels of the nervous system embedded in a really, really busy, busy body, you know, inhabited by roughly 100 times as many little microscopic creatures as, you know, there are cells in her body, right? The cells that we think of as Tricia are just like 1% of the total package. The rest are germs, essentially. You know, right? It's true for all of us. Like, I won't even get into the little mites crawling around our eyebrows because that would be way too creepy. But so here we are. Like, but we don't do that. We go, you. Just one word, you. Or her. We think, you know, easy to do it politically. Donald Trump, entity. Hillary Clinton, entity. You know, just Mickey Mouse, entity, right? Just entity. And that's kind of how we do it. It's very efficient, it's quick, there's some validity to it. There's just one body at least, you know. It'd be so confusing to keep track of all those sub-personalities inside, you know, ebbing and flowing. And then we go back the other way. It's really interesting. We presume that over here it's the same. There's just an entity over here somehow. But if you look really, really closely, you can't find it. Okay. So you see that process? The social construction of selfing, back and forth. It's really interesting. And one of the practices for me that I've done a lot is to try to not pin a personality on people so much, to give more room to breathe, to budge, and be more allowing, to recognize that I can look in here, it's a mess in here. So I figure if it's a mess in here, it's a zoo, it's a cacophony, it's like, whoa, so much, you know, and here, I am multitudes, right? The Walt Whitman line. It's also true for other people too. And to let them change, let them not pin on them. Well, you did that. They were just, that was just one of their 100 sub-personalities, right? You know, and it's not in charge any longer. Okay. So then I want to finish on this one point. Reflecting on children in childhood and with this distinction between persons and eyes, persons and selves. If a young child, especially children in general, does not feel truly safe and happy and loved as a person, that child will contract into a self. And that happens for almost everyone. So if you think about it, one of the great undoings of the contraction into self is to help yourself feel, when it's authentically true as much as possible, that you, the person process, are actually truly safe in your core, in your being, in your fundamental nature, you know, in your body as much as you can recognize that in this moment at least the body is safe. May not be in the next moment. It's slowly falling apart. That is true. But in this moment, at least, it's not imminently dying, right? So safe, and help yourself feel happy, and help yourself feel loved, and loving. Love's love flowing in or flowing out. Because as we do that, the contraction into selfing, you can just watch it, starts relaxing, and we come back out into the whole ocean of who we are. You know, the I is just one wave in the inner sea, but we tend to privilege it and identify with it and then hop on board it. And the more that we feel that our needs are being met, there's no basis for fear, anger, helplessness with what's unpleasant. There's no basis for frustration, drivenness, disappointment, addiction with what's, you know, pleasant. There's no basis for hurt or ill will or going to war with other people in terms of our connection needs. There's just no basis for it. Then there's no basis for I. We don't need the I in that moment. I is a phenomenal evolutionary invention. Humans have the strongest sense of I of any animals, best we know. We don't know about the cetaceans, but the others are pretty clear. They don't have that strong sense of I that we do. And maybe it helps us to have a strong sense of I. You know, I've had situations where they were life or death. I'm okay with paying the price for a while of a strong sense of I, you know, to deal with the various situations I was in. But a little bit of that goes a long way. So helping yourself feel like your core needs are met, because when core needs are met, there's less basis for selfing. Okay. The other thing in particular, which is so paradoxical, is to help yourself and let yourself feel really special. Really loved. In other words, to satisfy our normal narcissistic needs for empathy, for feeling special, for feeling cherished. You know, we tend to act really cool around those needs, and we tend to deny them and push them away, but that's just more selfing. It's a funny thing when that need is really, really taken care of, to feel in various appropriate ways, important or esteemed, cherished, sought, valued? To the extent it's true, and some of that we can bring to ourselves, then paradoxically, even as we give ourselves lots and lots of narcissistic supplies, people actually become less conceited. Usually, there are some major exceptions running for office these days. But most people do not become addicted to it. You know, they fill that hole inside themselves and they step out of kind of the hell realm that they're in, always chasing the next narcissistic reassurance, warding off dreaded humiliation at any price. Right? Most people don't keep doing that kind of stuff. Okay, anyway, I want to just kind of open up this topic. It's a big one, I, self. And in particular, just draw your attention to what's happening in your own experience that hopefully might be useful. You know, the last takeaway for me is just to try to be really, really careful about taking things too personally and getting attached to, also related, getting attached to my viewpoint about things, you know. Man, you could just see so much trouble that starts when you start taking things really, really personally. So just trying to be aware of that in real time when you are. Okay, what do you make of all this? Yeah.
Yeah, I want to put it to a couple ideas and get your
great reaction. Yeah.
One of which is, first of all, that this feels really good. I mean, it feels a releasing, relaxing, the idea of, it matches in sort of where I am now, but I'm thinking about other places where I have been, you know, middle school, high school, psychotherapy, social situations where the issue is lack of a self, lack of a sense of self, lack of boundaries between yourself and the other, feeling empty, like you're nothing but trying to copy somebody else.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. And then the other thing is relating it to the sense, the Christian sense of an eternal soul that lives within you.
Yeah.
Can you address one or both of
those? You really? Well, if I got you the first one, you know, the psychoanalyst slash I think Zen practitioner Epstein had this line: "You've got to become somebody before you can become. You've got to be somebody before you can become nobody." And he makes this point about healthy development, you know. And it gets very interesting then. You know, what is a somebody? Is it a person somebody, right? That is feels seen, or does it have to be this sort of ego entity inside? You know. I think it's really the person somebody. Okay, so it is true that we feel like, you know, I'm a nobody, right? We can. We're feeling very inadequate. But I think if you look really closely, it's one thing to feel sort of kind of one with everything. And so it's less important what happens locally, right? When people are in that place, I bet you could report from your own experience, other people could too, it feels really healthy, it feels good, it feels okay. You know, that's really different from feelings of inadequacy, which if you trace them down, usually are because some important need was not really met. So for me, that feeling of loneliness, I think implicit in there, not being included, not receiving a healthy incoming stream, given your temperament and personality and history. Some people naturally need more than others, right? Just like some people need more, I don't know what, iron or, you know, insulin than others. You know, that if we're not getting our necessary incoming stream of narcissistic supplies, given our nature, who we are, something feels off. A basic need is not being met, right? I think. And I think it's tricky. You got to be careful about the pitfalls around that, pulling for vanity. You know, what do you like about me today? You know, you have to be careful about that. But I just think flagging that. You know, I've known a lot of meditators, good-hearted people, that were carrying around like a ball and chain these unmet, fundamental, wholesome, natural, normal, social, narcissistic needs that they were in denial about, but that were really constraining their movement on the path of awakening.
Mm-hmm. You know? Can I have one?
Yeah, definitely, please.
Sorry, did I interrupt?
Oh, not at all.
I can't tell.
Yeah.
bear with me because I have a hard time talking out loud a little bit. Okay, you were saying about there is sound, and this is a very noisy place to meditate. It's one of the noisiest I've ever been at, except for San Francisco Zen Center with the cars and out there. So that means that it's a good place for me to meditate, because I used to get very, very upset with the sounds of people making noise, of the students out there yelling, of whatever. I reacted to it very strongly, but I do not anymore. But being here is a good place for me to practice, because I realized that I could see the thoughts that come before the reaction.
That's good.
They don't have the emotion that they used to have to them, but still the thoughts are there. Like today, I saw myself thinking, what are they doing making all that noise? But it doesn't have the punch to it, that it doesn't have any punch anymore. However,
that's
in
great.
My daily life, I do react quite excessively to things that a lot of people wouldn't react to at all. And I know that meditation has helped me to be able to meditate is the only time I'm still. And since I can do it then, I'm hoping it'll carry into everyday life. But you also said, don't put the I feel. Like when I thought, what are they doing? It was like, what are they doing to bother me? How dare they?
This is great. Yeah.
So that's all.
Thank you. That was great. Oh, you're right in real time. That's it. That's, you know, it's, I don't mean to be presumptuous, but I think that's what the Buddha's talking about in the third foundation of mindfulness, that we have that kind of granularity of mindfulness in real time and tracking this, including, I'm kind of calling it out tonight, you know, this rising and falling sense of I, right? And it gets interesting if you can kind of play with it like this. Like, where it tends to often show up is where we feel provoked or mistreated. Lately, again, it's hard not to do this, given the politics, to really reflect on how vulnerable we are to feeling aggrieved and how compelling the sense of grievance is, and even a kind of draw to feeling aggrieved when there's actually little to no basis for it, truly. Why would people want to feel aggrieved? It seems like such an unpleasant experience. There's something in us, and I think in part because it enforces tribal loyalty. And it's a classic way that authoritarian types, you know, hold on to or gain profit and power by playing on grievance, fear, and anger. We're very vulnerable to that. I think a little bit like we're vulnerable to gorging on carbohydrates. You know, that made sense during the long run of evolution. Just like it made sense in terms of staying alive and passing on genes that passed on genes to, you know, defer to alphas who would, you know, play on grievance, fear, and anger. But, wow, it's strange, the power of that and the draw to that. So watching that in yourself. You know, I'll watch myself, like my wife will do the least thing. There we are, it's all fine. I'm pretty chilled out. She's really sweet. We love each other. We've been married a long time. And she'll sniff at something I said, or her eyes will wander back to Huffington Post or something terrible. And like, you know, there's like so much self in that. Anyway, so, okay, other examples? Yeah, please.
Yeah, I really debated as to whether I should bring this one up because it's really humiliating.
All the better.
Okay, so I'm many things. Tile contractor is one of them, and I'm working this big job in San Francisco, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm parked on this really narrow street. There's all these other trucks on here, and I go out, and my side mirror is busted. So I'm looking at it, and the first thing that pops up is I'm going to catch the sucker.
I'm gonna get him. Grievance and vengeance. Yeah.
So, you know, just to show that, you know, I can take care of this. I drove down to the place and bought a new one, put it in the car, right? I come out and it's broke again.
What do you mean, so I can take care of it? You mean like I could be evolved and not?
Well, I could be, you know, who's ever trying to hurt me, I'm going to show them.
Okay.
Take care of this. So all right. I go down, I do this number, and it's okay. I go out, it's broken. And this time, I know it's somebody on the job site. So I go around, you know, and I'm looking at eyes and eyeballs, and I'm going, oh. And they're actually smiling at me, but I know that one of you guys did this, right? So, I mean, this is getting crazy. And I just graduated from here in counseling psychology, so I'm watching this go on.
That's great. So it's horrible, too. But
yeah, it is, but I can't stop myself. So I go out, and I said, well, wait a minute. Maybe there's more to this story. And I look up and down the street, and right in front of my truck was a smaller vehicle, a car, and the light was broken and hanging off. I see. So it's a narrow street.
Yeah.
My big truck has big ears on it, right?
Yeah.
And something came by and just knocked the thing off. That's all there was to it.
Yeah.
But I made this whole thing up, and I felt, I mean, it was really emotionally charged. But, you know, and so it was so funny. I went out and I got one of the contractors and brought him out, and I told him the whole story, and we practically died laughing.
That's very far out.
Grab onto something.
Do you mind saying, like, what happened for you inside after when you realized that this impersonal process, it's a drag, but this truck came through, right? It wasn't personal. No one was targeting you.
Exactly.
It was just one of those crummy things that happens in life. And, you know, like, what happened inside you when you realized all that?
Well, the first thing I thought about, of course, is that I'm heavily conditioned to take things personally like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it was a great opportunity to just work on it and see it happen and then, you know, try to not personalize everything.
That's right.
So it was a challenge.
Yeah. A version of that for me is it's this weirdly scary moment, but then it becomes like happy and free when you realize you actually don't matter very much to most people.
Well, I wasn't going to mention that one.
You know, like, right?
How important am I that somebody's going to come and crash my mirror, right?
Yeah, yeah, or it's weird to realize that. It's like, even honestly, you realize in your family system, your friends, they're not thinking about you all the time, right? Well, what's wrong with that? You know, and yet on the other hand, when you flip the other way, suddenly it gives you so much room to breathe, so much freedom, so much room to move in, you know, because you just be you. Just be you, you know, unfolding. There's a traditional parable about the log. I think it's from Taoism. I've written up about it. Other people have too. I'll leave this little parable for you, okay? It goes like this. I'm going to update a little bit. You're with your friend in a canoe in a slowly moving river. And it's Sunday, and it's a happy day, it's a picnic. Everything's really sweet. You're dressed up, got your grandmother's special super silver in the canoe. You're eating your lovely gourmet, you know, meal. Suddenly, there's a loud thump on the side of your canoe. Boom! And it tips you over and dumps you into the cold river. Okay? You come up sputtering. You're really upset. And what do you see? You see a couple of teenagers with goggles, snorkels, and fins have swum down to your canoe, tipped it over, and are laughing at you. How do you feel, and what do you want to do? Okay? Then, take two. Now, everything's the same. You're in the canoe in the river with your friend. It's picnic time, all dressed up, grandmother's silverware, loud thump on the side of your canoe, boom. You're tipped over, you're dumped into the river, grandma's silver goes to the bottom, cannot recover it, clothes are ruined, hair's ruined. You come up sputtering, what do you see? You see a large submerged log has drifted downstream and smacked into your canoe. It's an impersonal process, like a truck in a narrow street. How do you feel then? See the difference? It's really radical to play with that and to realize that most people in your life are just logs. They were launched upstream, 10,000 causes upstream led them your way, right? It doesn't diminish the impact. And, you know, it doesn't minimize anything. We're not minimizing anything or letting anybody else off the hook, you know? And there's a place for being compassionate to yourself and dealing with the situation as best you can. And there's even a place for learning from the log event. So, you know, maybe get different mirrors or, you know, be a little more on the watch out for the log or something, and maybe even go to a different river, one with fewer logs or people like that. But on the whole, it changes everything when you regard it much more as an impersonal process. You don't feel so implicated in it. You know, I realize this kind of funny saying for myself, I'm not implicated in your mind stream. Now, if I have to say that to myself, there's probably a problem going on between us here. But to know that, to realize I'm mostly not implicated in the other person's mind stream, because it's happening for all kinds of reasons that don't have anything really to do with me. Doesn't mean I should be a jerk. Doesn't mean I shouldn't take responsibility for my piece of it. But it just means that so much else is just not about me. And then you can see what that does to suffering more or less. Flip the other way. We're crashing into all kinds of people all day long as logs, cutting them off, being brisk or brusque, a little snippy in our tone, rolling our eyes, people local to us, emails. I'm astonished at what people post online, you know, in all kinds of ways, a kind of freedom to say or do things that are just crazy. You know, so it's the other side of it is how are we smashing into other people, you know, being logs to them. How about we sit for a minute? Just let it sink in. Be well. Take care. See you next week.
Yeah. So I'm really intrigued.